welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here for episode 210 and part one of my conversation with Western Michigan University percussion and music professor, Marya Kearney. Let's get right to it. Marya is very recently a member of the faculty at Western Michigan, where she has been working alongside Pete's somewhat recent guest, Judy Moonert. She's also been very active as a performer and educator throughout the United States, predominantly in the last 10 years or so. She has been active with her duo, Duo 421, with clarinetist Jessica Hallspeak, and has been teaching at a number of different colleges during her time in the professor world. All of that would be enough to have a solid interview. Well, it turns out that we share a number of other somewhat unusual items in common. We both stayed at our respective institutions for our master's and doctorate degrees. We both have spouses in higher education that we have both followed after and been followed by for employment. And we both have had the opportunity to teach courses outside of the percussion world during our employment at various schools. As I've stated before, the opportunity to chat with my guests on so many topics that may only be tangentially related to percussion is one of the reasons I enjoy doing this show. I'm grateful for the chance to talk to all of my guests, and it's one of the reasons why I have another two-part interview for you. So this week, you'll hear about Marya's current job, the effect of the coronavirus, Duo 421, her experience teaching a course on protest music, her upbringing, and her years at Michigan State University as an undergrad. Next week, you'll hear the rest of the story. One note before we get started, I have been having major issues recently with my recordings, and I'm not totally sure what the problem is, but hopefully I will figure out a solution soon. So when you hear some audio issues or changes that have been occurring, realize that I'm using the original and the backup recordings that I do to get the job done. I wish this wasn't the case, but it is, so be forewarned. All right, let's get to it. We recorded this interview over Skype on September 22nd, 2020, and it begins right now.
I like your Dr. Kearney office. That's pretty sweet.
Thanks. That's actually, I'm not the first Dr. Kearney in my family. That actually hung outside of a medical practice in the 1890s from my great, however many great grandpas. He was a doctor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay.
My mom hoarded that for years. I didn't know that it existed. And so when I finished my doctorate, that was my present.
That's great.
Yeah.
It does, now that you say it, does look old timey.
Yep. It's got one long crack down the middle because it's actually a glass sign.
Mm-hmm.
But it's framed, so it's held together pretty nicely. So.
Excellent. Marya, give me a summation of your percussion activities and other teaching activities as they are at this point.
So I currently teach at Western Michigan University. This is my second year there. It's kind of nice that this isn't my first year, I suppose, with the the pandemic and everything happening. So it usually takes a while to get, you know, gigs working, things like that. And so that's not really happening yet because I had only been here for less than a year before everything shut down. So I'm pretty much just doing the teaching thing right now. But in the last three semesters, I suppose I've taught Theory 1, Theory 2, a music appreciation class, percussion methods, percussion ensemble, and percussion lessons. So a wide range of things.
Now, where were you right before you were at Western Michigan?
Right before, I was at Kennesaw State University, which is in the suburbs of Atlanta. I was there for 2 years. And then before that, I was in Florida for 7 years at Stetson University.
Got it. Now, were your teaching responsibilities similar at all these places?
Ironically, every new job I get, there's something that they need that I've never done before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when I got to Kennesaw State, they needed oral skills, and I had never taught oral skills before, but I was game. And, you know, as a first year faculty member at a new university, you say yes to pretty much anything that you can. So, and then prior to that, I had developed a protest music class at Stetson when they needed something extra. And they also needed a history, music history professor at Stetson. So I did that. And then I got to Western and they needed a theory professor. So it seems like everywhere I go, I kind of have to add something to my repertoire of skills. So it's challenging, but it's good because I've pretty much done everything except keyboard skills at this point, as far as typical music classes go.
I assume you're not teaching. Are you teaching cello lessons or
on the side?
Choir?
No, I'm not. I have never taught anything but percussion as far as that goes.
Nice. At Western Michigan, what are the what's the kind of like the studio situation, like the technique situation, all that?
The percussion professor who has been at Western for 40 years, actually, she kind of took a step down this year, and she's now part-time. And so we're kind of splitting the studio right now. And
is that Judy?
Judy Mooner.
Yeah.
And I think she was planning to retire after this year, but then everything kind of happened. And so things are changing maybe a little faster than she had originally anticipated. So she went down to part-time, and I moved away from the theory and music appreciation stuff that I was doing to take on the rest of the percussion area. So there are two of us that teach classical percussion. And then there's one other percussion professor who does the jazz studies. So three total. As far as methods goes, it's offered once a year in the spring. So I had to shift online in the spring, but I haven't had to do anything with it this semester. So I don't anticipate the spring being a whole lot different than what we're doing now. But so that happens in the spring. And then there's percussion ensemble as well, which meets twice a week.
At this point for Western Michigan, what's been the, and you go back to, you know, March on this, what's been kind of the progression for the school and how they, and you've all dealt with the virus pretty much?
Yeah, so Michigan was kind of on the forefront of making decisions about things. So we shut down pretty quickly. I think our first positive was March 11th, and that was the day that they shut down universities. And those were university decisions, but they pretty much all fell like dominoes in at least the days after that. And then the following Monday on the 16th, that was when our governor put the stay-at-home order in place. So at that point, campus was pretty much shut down. And as far as percussionists goes, that was really difficult for them. I think it was the right decision, but campus was actually shut down. Like, students could not step foot on campus, and faculty needed, you know, an act of Congress to get onto campus.
Right.
So it was pretty difficult to shift. Everybody pretty much switched their lessons to like either snare drum or accessories, mm-hmm. whatever they had available. And we just kind of made it work throughout the rest of that semester. In percussion methods, I was luckily already through timpani and a lot of the basic stuff I do at the beginning we had already gotten through. So we were just moving on to accessories at that point, tambourine, triangle, drum set, that kind of stuff. So I was able to make some videos and post them from my home, which wouldn't have been possible with timpani because I don't have timpani. So it worked pretty well. We kind of limped through the semester. And then now Western has pretty much left it up to faculty to decide how we want to handle our classes. So we can be face-to-face, we can be hybrid, we can be online. I was pretty nervous with going back, especially being pregnant, which gives you a suppressed immune system. I was pretty worried about that. But when I first got onto campus, it's really dead. It seems like most professors, if they could move online, they did. It looks like the summer on campus. I mean, I don't really see, I don't see 10 people on my walk from my car to the building. So that's been a little helpful to my own peace of mind. All of my students wanted to be face-to-face, percussion ensemble and private lessons. So we've been doing that so far, and we just kind of go week by week and see how everybody feels about it. But at this point, you know, we have all the resting hours throughout the day, and I have a good HEPA filter in the studio, and I actually only go in, my lessons are crazy spaced out, so I actually go home in between pretty much every lesson. So I'll have like a lesson at 11:30 in the morning and then a lesson at 4 in the afternoon. And so I just zip in there, do my stuff, and then hit the road. So that's pretty much how it looks up here. Michigan in general is still taking it pretty seriously, so.
And I mean, as we all know, when your governor gave the orders, it seemed like all the citizens took it really well. Oh wait, maybe not.
not really. I happen to live. I mean, Kalamazoo is a pretty crunchy place, and so we were kind of insulated for the most part to the more rural areas that had a bigger problem with it. And to a certain extent, I can understand if you live in a town where you maybe only see 10 other humans in a day, it can feel like, yeah, we're always spaced out. We can handle this. You don't close our restaurants or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was, I mean, at least around here, it felt pretty calm and everybody was on the same page. We also just tend to go to the kind of grocery stores and whatnot where people would hopefully take it more seriously. So you couldn't pay me enough to walk into a Walmart right now, but you know, going to the bougie grocery store has been just fine. So.
Right. No, I hear you. So are they with the kind of like in the in-person sections, does this mean for you kind of personally that you don't have, there's not a class that you have like that many people that's actually in person? Like, are there limits to how many they allow in certain rooms and things like that?
Yeah. And there are blanket limits for the university. I don't recall exactly what it is. I vaguely recall it being around 60, like, if you have more than 60 students, you are online. Like, there is no way to do this safely.
Yeah.
So all the theory classes are online because our theory classes aren't split up into sections. There's like one theory one and one theory two. So when I taught theory, I think there were 68 students in my class. So that is not possible on campus. So all of those are online, which then opened up those like lecture hall type rooms to move classes that are more like 30 people into, to space out a little bit. So I think the hardest part has been the ensembles. They're the ones that are struggling the most, I think. this may just be because I'm married to one of the band directors, so I hear about it a lot, but it's impossible to fit a band into a room. We don't have a space that big to space everybody out. So sometimes they go outside for rehearsals, but in Michigan, the opportunity for outdoor rehearsals is quickly going away. I think yesterday for my husband's 8 a.m. class, it was 44 degrees. That's not going to be an option for too much longer. But as far as my classes go, only 5 percussionists signed up for a percussion ensemble this semester. And so it's easy to have, and I didn't even choose any quintets. I did all trios and duos. So there are only 4 of us in a space at one time, and rehearsals are half an hour long. So it's been pretty easy for me to follow very strict guidelines that I maybe imposed on myself.
Agree completely with the ensemble directors are doing like all these flex pieces that have smaller ensembles. And every time I go, I'll walk around our build. I'm at Mizzou, but every time I walk around our building, I'll see that like all the directors are just hanging outside because it's the interim period where the room has to clear.
Yep.
Like they do the half hour and then there's 20 minutes and then they go back. And you just see, they're just like, I'm sure your husband's the same way. Just like, what, you know?
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, I really feel for them. Our director of bands has a very immunocompromised wife at home. Mm. So he's stressed out all the time. My husband is stressed out all the time because I'm pregnant. My husband is also the director of the marching band.
Oh, yeah.
So that has sort of, there's a hybrid situation going on there. So there's a virtual component and then there's an optional face-to-face component. So it's like, if you really, really, really want to have a marching band experience, we can do that and we can do it safely, but you don't have to participate in it.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought those numbers were going to be very, very low. And it turns out, it's like 150 students who opted for the face-to-face. So he had to actually split that option into 2 different days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, figuring out how to follow all the guidelines and do all this safely, but still create some sort of experience. It's just, it's a lot.
Yeah. I'm the assistant director of our marching band. So it's same. We know the same. All the same. I know everything you just said. I'm like, yep. Virtual.
Yep. Yeah.
And does Western Michigan have are they playing football this year?
So we're in the MAC,
mm-hmm.
and the MAC, so the Big Ten is where we are geographically.
Right.
And so pretty much Michigan State was the first one to make decisions about closing campus, about what they were going to do for their fall plans. They've kind of been on the forefront of that. And then the other universities in the state sort of use that as a blueprint, because if you go against what somebody's already decided, then it's like, well, do you have different information than you? And so when the Big Ten decided that they were going to start playing football again, then, I don't know, that day, 12 hours later, maybe, it was like, okay, so the MAC is going to meet this weekend and talk about football. But they didn't actually come to any decisions this past weekend. So still waiting. We don't know if they're going to try to put a fall lineup together or if they're going to try for spring. So it's still a little up in the air, but no plans as of yet.
Okay. Yeah, I remember they were one of the first schools that they might have been the first conference that shut down the football.
Yeah, it was pretty early.
Yeah. Who knows? That's wild. So does that mean, so they haven't decided yet. So he doesn't even still, right?
Right. He's just kind of, there are a couple like drive-by gigs that are happening. And so he's thinking about ways that they can still do things. He's also teaching pregame drill this year and tunes, so that next year there won't be more than half the band that's never learned pregame, which would make it even harder. Our pregame is really long. So, yeah, that's going to start, I think, this week. So still getting some stuff done and kind of prepping, like, now they're learning stands tunes just in case they have to do football.
Oh, it's wild.
Yeah.
Changes by the minute. So one of the classes that I did want to ask you about, because you had mentioned it, but I've also seen you talk about it, social media, is this is the protest music class. I want to know more about it, because it's one that I might get to teach some version of that as well.
So it started at Stetson University. I got the opportunity to teach what they call a freshman seminar. The freshman seminar at Stetson took the place of like English 101. And from what I understand, English 101 was kind of a dry situation that all the students dreaded taking, and their writing wasn't all that great because they weren't interested in the content or something. And so the idea to do a seminar to make sure that all the students were getting to college level writing before they actually launched into higher level stuff. But what they realized is, like, the content doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter what they're writing about. We just want them to care about writing.
Yeah.
So they to have professors teach just random stuff, like whatever they were excited about or interested in. And the students, the only rule was that you couldn't choose a seminar that was taught by a professor within your major. And so it was really pushing students out of their comfort zone, maybe into just a general topic that they thought was interesting. I mean, there were seminars on Game of Thrones, on tattoo artistry, on gardening, you know, whatever. Like, and so it was actually a really fascinating option for professors too, because you got to teach something that maybe wasn't even within your area of expertise. If it was just a hobby of yours, you could do something like that, because the content doesn't matter. They don't actually have to learn anything about this topic. They just need a springboard to write about something.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got the opportunity to do this. And at first I was thinking, well, who doesn't like drums? I mean, this is going to be super easy. I'll just teach a seminar on drums and non-musicians will take it and it'll be super cool. But I talked to another music professor who had done one of these, and he was like, you know, this is the only opportunity you're probably ever going to have to teach whatever you want. I mean, you don't even have to be that good at teaching it, because it's not content that they're going to have to know for something else. It's just for fun, you know? And so, like, what are your hobbies? And I looked at him like he had three heads. It's like, you have hobbies?
Right.
Are you kidding? Why don't I have time for hobbies? And he was like, okay, all right, fair enough. And so he suggested that I go home and make myself a cocktail and sit in front of my bookshelves. He's like, if you look at the books that you have, that will tell you where your interests are. You might not even notice, you know, what you're interested in. And so I did that, and I went home and I looked at my books, and I pretty much had two categories. I had books about music, not necessarily the books that I used to teach or whatever, but books about music and books about social issues. And all of a sudden, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. I've unwittingly been researching protest music like since I was in high school. I mean, it's always been something that interested me, and it never even occurred to me that it was something that I had been researching basically for 20 years. And I looked at my Spotify playlists, and I had all this stuff, and I had a lot of knowledge about the background of this stuff just because I was interested in it. And so that's what I did. I developed a class, and I did more research, and I crowdsource some other, you know, favorites, other songs that people really thought were important to the topic. And I basically focused on American protest music from the 1930s to present. And the angle that I really wanted to use was how protest music fit into the history of the country. So the book I actually used, the book I had them buy, is actually just a history textbook. It's not a dry history textbook. It certainly has a point of view to it, but it's like, here's what was happening in the country, and then I would add the music into it. It wasn't a music book in any way, but...
What's, you know, the book?
It's called The Unfinished Journey.
Okay.
The author's last name is Chafee, I think, C-H-A-F-E. But it's a great, great book, and it does a lot of synthesis of information. Like, here's what happened, and here's why that was important at the time, you know? And so then I would add musical examples to that, and we talk about what that person must have been feeling when they were going through this period of history, and then they wrote this song. How are those two things connected? And it was a really, really exciting class to teach. Ironically, the first time I taught it was fall of 2016. So that was a difficult semester to teach about the history of the United States.
Yeah.
And in the strangest twist of fate, the morning after the election was the day chronologically where I was going to explain the 2000 election to them.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it was so very, I mean, I had this whole thing planned about how crazy it was that you could, you know, win the popular vote and lose the election and da 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 and all this stuff. And it was just, it was a poignant lecture, I think.
Yeah. Did you go to PASIC that year?
I believe I did. Yeah.
Because it showed up. I remember in Matt Henry had a clinic about race in percussion, basically, that was so good. It was one of my favorite things I ever saw. Just like through the, I guess like the diver, it was like a diversity world music thing, but it was just a. Anyway, because I drove to PASIC that morning, like the morning after the election, and I remember driving by myself, no music, like I drove in silence for like four of the 5.5 hours of that trip. I've never done that in my entire life.
It's like sometimes there's just too much in your head that you can't fit anything else in it.
Yeah. Wow, I can't imagine teaching right after
that. It was wild. And you know, when I look back, I remember, you know, for instance, when we were talking about JFK, I was trying to explain to them how crazy that election was. And I was trying to explain how distrustful we were as a country of Catholics being president.
Oh, right.
And so I was saying that, you know, people were worried that the Pope was going to be in charge, and just trying to get them in the mindset of how big of a deal that election was in that way. And so then we talked about, you know, what would be today's version of that? Like, what is the craziest thing you can come up with for somebody, you know, getting elected? And the side note to that discussion was, well, we're about to see a woman become president, so that's not that crazy anymore. But what else would be crazy? And so, you know, it becomes like, how about a gay person? Yeah, okay, maybe that would, you know, who knows how long that will take. And then so I said, well, how about a Muslim? And they all, you know, their eyes got kind of wide. And yeah, I don't think that's going to happen for a while. And then I said, how about an atheist? And they said, Yeah, I think that's the craziest. I think that's the least likely to happen. I said less likely than a Muslim. That is something to think about, you know? And so we had this lively discussion about what it must have felt like in the 60s to elect a Catholic, but the whole underpinning of that was like, it's not crazy to elect a woman because it's gonna happen in a few weeks. And yeah, it didn't.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm glad you're telling me, you're saying all this, because this is exactly the kind of thing that I love about, I teach a class mostly for journalism students about writing for the arts, and it gets into a lot of topics. We talk about politics and identity and money and lots of other issues, whether they're like specifically music, but we like all the stuff you're talking about is exactly the kinds of things that I love discussing in these classes. Because like you're saying, you're giving them a way in that they may not see, or a way of putting it all together that they just weren't aware of.
I mean, you know, learning history in high school, I remember how dry that was. My favorite subject, and it is probably my most favorite subject now, you know, as far as like regular topics go, the typical things that you would learn in an educational setting. I hated history because it was just memorizing dates and stuff. So remembering how that felt to me, I wanted to connect it better for them, because a lot of the things that they learned, they didn't actually learn how to synthesize the information and how to understand why it was important or not. And they also told me, this is 2016, and they told me that their history classes, their American history classes, only went up to Reagan. So they didn't actually know anything really about 9/11, other than just the videos that people post every year. They didn't know anything about Obama's election. They didn't know who Sarah Palin was. I mean, it's just, I had to teach all of that to them, and that was... it was disheartening, but it was also exciting for me to have the opportunity to give them that information.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so great. One of the things that's kind of, I think you've also realized with the protest music, is that the amount of protest songs are endless, essentially.
And depending on how you hear them or what you believe to be a protest song, you know, it could change how you hear something. But I always love, there are always students who come up to me after the lectures and say, have you ever heard this song? I think you should add this to your list. And that's really cool. I love that they're listening to their own stuff. And sometimes they come to realize that a song that they've just loved forever, now they're listening to the words and realizing that it's about something bigger. And they get really excited about that too. So I love when they take the information that we're talking about and then just apply it to the things that they're already experiencing. That's the best.
Yeah. Do you teach Mississippi Goddamn?
I don't.
That one's fun because Nina Simone uses the the classic Broadway kind of the doot doot doot, like that kind of feel. And so when I teach it, I show them a clip of The Music Man to give them a sense of like it in like Broadway use, and also like I try to find the whitest version of it, and then I put her version right next to it, and you just see the demurs like, I don't know what's going on right now. I was like, yes.
That's funny.
So yeah, that's great. I like I said, I'm realizing slowly just the amount of music, and I've had exactly the same experience with the having students will throw me like a, it's like, this also seems like a thing, or why haven't you talked about the, well, now the Chicks, but like the Dixie Chicks, and I'm like, yes exactly.
Yep, that song is on my list for sure. But I do love when, I mean, if they try to talk me into getting something on the list, it's like, I have done my job.
Yeah.
Care about this enough to come, like, you know, almost try to call me out. Like,
right.
Why is it here? I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
But one of the newest ones is The Pill that I've done. Loretta Lynn, do you know that one?
Oh, no.
Oh, man, because that's about The Pill. Yeah. But it's in the context of her career and also amongst other songs that she wrote about basically like telling her husband hands off, like I've had enough kids kind of thing. And it's great. So
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah. So, anyway, yeah, that's awesome. Now I'm thrilled. You've got, I hope you do get to, teach it again soon.
Yeah. And I've gotten to present at other universities and, festivals and things like that. I'm actually presenting to the marching band, in a month or two, just because they're the way that they're moving here at Western for the virtual aspect is talking about the things that they don't get to talk about very much: leadership, diversity and inclusion, you know, all the stuff that they wish they could talk about, but gotta get the shows on the field, you know.
Right.
So I'm gonna kind of fill in that diversity checklist, I guess, and present a little bit on some protest music. So I get to talk about it a little bit this year, but yeah, I'm looking forward to trying to fit a class in somewhere.
That's awesome. Tell me a little bit about your duo, 421.
So my duo started with a good friend of mine at Stetson University. She was one of the clarinet professors there, Jessica Hallspeak, and she, we both really liked playing together, and we wanted to figure out a way how to do that more often. So we started out just using some pieces that we could find that we liked, and we really found some that we loved. And then we started to put together a recital and thought about maybe it would be cool if we could commission something. So then we ended up going down that route with my friend Baljinder Sikhan, who was interested in writing a piece for us. And he's probably my favorite living percussion composer right now. And so that was really exciting, and we got to collaborate a lot with him in the writing process, which led to premiering that at Clarinet Fest in 2017, I want to say. So that was a really cool experience. And he had a lot of really cool ideas that we were very excited about. So he wanted to blend the idea of woodwind instrument and percussion so that the clarinet player actually plays some percussion stuff and the percussionist plays some wind stuff in the form of harmonica. So it was truly like two instruments sort of enmeshed together. That was a really fun experiment to do, and the piece ended up being super cool. It's called Two Trees, and it's a really, really cool piece, a duo. And so we did some recitals. We did a recital or two at Stetson, and she was doing her doctorate at Florida State, so we did a recital up there, and we did the Clarinet Fest. And unfortunately, right when we were just getting going, I left for Kennesaw State in 2017. And so we still have kind of hopeful plans to get together and do stuff, but now we're even further apart. So she was deep into doing her doctorate, which she just finished, and you know, now I've got a baby on the way. So it's kind of stalled at this point, but we still, every time we talk about how it would be great to get back into it. So hopefully we'll be able to do that soon.
What was Clarinet Fest like?
You know, it was my first non-percussion conference. I mean, I've done like music ed conferences. I've done web and things like that. But it was my first experience with an instrument conference that wasn't PASIC. And it was wild. It was totally different. I had heard that it was different because I had hosted non-percussionists at PASIC before, and so they had described all the differences to me already, but it was just so sweet, like their little hall where they have all of the clarinets available. It's like, you know, one ballroom with the divider taken out, and it was just very sweet, much easier to walk around, much more accessible, less things happening all at the same time. So it's a little less intimidating, I suppose. It was much more of an intimate setting because just everything could be smaller. I did feel a little out of place. not in a bad way, because the theme that year was, I think it was like clarinet and other instrument. So there were a lot of duos happening with clarinet and somebody else. And there were actually, it could have been clarinet and percussion. Because I do remember there were quite a few other percussionists there, but it was fun to be able to play in that sort of setting for a room full of non-percussionists. Because they were probably looking at her more than they were looking at me. It was kind of nice. I'm an introvert, so the performance aspect is not always my favorite thing. But at least if there's one more person up there with me, I'm totally fine. And so knowing that they were all probably staring at her was a super chill moment for me. But it was definitely a different experience from PASIC, for sure. Mm.
But there was someone in the ballroom playing an E-flat clarinet and playing the Porgy and Bess, right? I mean, that did happen.
Musicians are all the same. there were squeaks and all kinds of high things going on. It just is not quite as annoying as...
You should have just brought your drum set with you and just started jamming, just assuming that there would be other people playing drum set.
Honestly, that was one of the things that we talked about with Valjinder when he was writing the piece. It's like, we want to be able to take this to different places. So we want it to be pretty easy to move stuff. Like if there are big things, make them normal big things that we could borrow, you know, and if there are little things, make them little enough that I can take like a bag and it'd be fine. But still, so I mean, tiny setup. It was like bass drum and vibes and then like wood blocks and wooden chimes and things like that. You know, pretty easy. But I'm pulling this stuff out and the clarinetists are like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you brought all this stuff. Like, nothing.
That's awesome. All right, well, Maria, let's back up. Where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in Michigan. I never anticipated ending up back here, but I was born in Dayton, Ohio, and was there until I was about 5. And then we moved up to Michigan. My mom was in the automotive industry, so she got transferred to Detroit. And so starting in first grade, I was in Michigan, and then stayed throughout K-12 in the same school district, Clarkston, Michigan, which is about 35 miles north of Detroit, but it's a huge metropolitan area, so still considered a suburb of Detroit. And so then I stayed in state for college. My first year actually was at Kalamazoo College, so that's right across the street from Western, so it was interesting to end up back in the same town. I wasn't sure that I wanted to do music at that point, so I just picked a college that I wanted to go to, and Kalamazoo was my top choice, and so I did early admission, and I got accepted, and I, you know, went, and it was awesome. If I had done anything else, I would have stayed at K. It was an amazing experience, probably the most formative year of my life. But about 6 weeks into it, I realized that I missed music too much. And so the great music professors at K were very supportive of me transferring. And so they set me up really well for transfer auditions. And so I ended up at Michigan State to finish out my degree. And then I went to UMKC for my master's and doctorate.
Back in, is Dayton a place, another like automotive area?
It is, yeah. It's, well, University of Dayton is a really big engineering school, which is where my mom went for her engineering degree. So there are plenty of plants and offices and things down there. It's not obviously the motor hub that Detroit is, but it definitely is still within that sort of automotive radius in the country. So that's where her career started, but yeah, ended up north, as many people do in the industry.
Do you have any family members in the arts?
Not really. My dad, he was not in my life, and I've only met him once, but he always wanted to be like a rock star, sort of Allman Brothers kind of rock star. And so he was big into like playing guitar and things like that. But he was also an engineer. That's just, you know, that was sort of more the generation of like, you do something stable and you do something that is an acceptable career to your parents or whatever. Sure. So he didn't get to be a rock star. He became an engineer. My mom wanted to be a dancer, but again, not a viable career choice, so she became an engineer. So there's some creative sort of blood there, but nobody actually took the plunge. And I think my mom was really supportive of me wanting to do this, and I think she saw herself a little bit. Like, I didn't get to do the thing that I wanted to do, so you should get to do the thing that you want to do. And I give her a hard time now because it's like, I wish she would have just made me do something that I could have made money in, because, you know, I'm still crossing my fingers to make a living wage here. So that would have been nice. But she was very supportive of my career trajectory. So that was nice.
Just jumping ahead a sec, is that when you go to Kalamazoo College, is that in a, I'm not going to do music, so I'm going to pick another field. Like, was that the kind of the original thought when you're there?
No, I was kind of an idiot. I sort of thought, like, I don't know, maybe I'll do music, maybe not, who knows. And since I didn't have these conversations with my band director in high school, he had no idea that I was considering maybe doing music. So I think we had a really good music program at Croxton, and, you know, even just the year that I graduated, I think there are four or five of us who are, still in music, and like most of us have doctorates, and, you know, for 1 year, I mean, that's kind of a big group of people to do what we do. And, so he had good advice to give. I just didn't include him in my thought process. And so I think I kind of thought that like, you could just go to college and then like sophomore year, when they ask you what you want to major in, you could say music. So I didn't really understand how involved all of that was. And so when I got to Kalamazoo, there's a music program there, but it's largely extracurricular for the biology majors, you know, and so there's an orchestra, and there's a band, and there's a jazz band, and you can take lessons, and there was percussion ensemble and all of that, but nobody, you could major in music, but there were very few people who were doing it. And so I was automatically, as a freshman, the most talented percussionist there. And I'm not saying I was a phenom at all. It's just that was the level. It was just for fun, you know, just to keep your hands moving while you're getting your fancy degree in something else. And so when I mentioned that I was considering majoring in music, they were great. And they were like, it'd be awesome if you stayed here, but you can't stay here. You have to go else. And so they were the ones who explained to me, like, no, this is what you have to do. So.
Right. I hear you. Yeah. So at what point does music enter your life?
You know, it was like sixth grade. Just at the point where you have to decide, you know, are you going to do choir or band or art? It's like you had to pick something. And of those, I just thought that band was probably the coolest. I had an uncle who played drums. He was not a percussionist. He was a drummer. He's the first one to say that. And I just thought he was super cool. He was younger than my mom, and he was like the cool uncle who would play outside with me and whatever. So it's like, he plays drums. I'll play drums. Yeah, that sounds cool. And so back in the day, like, this will show how old I am. They used to drive around to your house. Like, the music person would drive to your house with a van full of instruments and set up in your living room and do your playing test to figure out what instrument you were going to play. Mm. And like, creepy stalker van with no windows.
Of course. Yeah.
You know? And my mom was a single mom who was very dedicated to her career. So it was hard to find a time to get this guy to come out. So by the time he came to my house, I'm like one of the last kids, and he already knows what the numbers are. And he's got a very specific thing to do for the band director. You know, it's like, he doesn't have any oboes. He doesn't have any whatever, you know, he's got too many bones, whatever the case may be. So he comes into my house and he goes, so what do you want to play? Just because that's what he asks everybody, even though he knows what he wants me to play. Right. He asks me, and I say, I want to play the drums. And he goes, how about the oboe? And I don't know what's happening. And so I was like, no, thank you. I want to play the drums. And he goes, yeah, how about the oboe? And I'm looking at my mom like, what is going on right now? I don't even know what an oboe is. Like, what are you talking about? And like, no, I want to play the drums. Like, clearly you're not hearing me. And he is so exasperated with this 11-year-old, you know, who is like putting her foot down. And so he rolls his eyes and he takes a deep breath and he's like, okay, you know, we have enough boys to play the drums.
Right.
And a feminist was born. I mean, I cared less, really, in the grand scheme of things. But all of a sudden, it's like, not only am I going to play the drums, but I'm better than all those boys. You just wait. You know, it's like, as soon as you tell me that I can't do something, that's my motivator. So I really didn't care that much, but I was very externally motivated from that point on. So I was very dedicated, only enough to get to first chair. Like, all I would work up until the point that I could win the chair test. And then I would stop practicing. And then as soon as, you know, chair two got annoyed with me being chair one, he would try to take it from me. And then I'd practice for a few days and keep my chair. And so I had zero personal motivation until late high school, maybe even early college. It was all very externally motivated, people telling me that I couldn't do it.
A sad and a great story. I was thinking it's like, internally, it's like, you've already purchased your first social justice book, right? Right at the moment. Right.
The setup was very early.
Right. Wow. Well, and I don't know. Did he think that if he just totally put gender into it, that it was like you were gonna come to your place or some BS like that?
I don't think it even occurred to him that he was being gendered. I think he was saying a fact. Like, you know, I already have enough people to do this. and you're not going to tell me how I'm going to do this. But it was, he sort of showed his colors, like, not only do we not have a spot for you, but there, girls don't do this either. So, right. No, yeah, it was weird.
Wow. What's the progression for you then as you go through high school? Are you taking lessons as well? Are you on all of the instruments as fast, or what happens?
I had a lot of natural talent, and I say that not in a good way, because my natural talent got me as far as I needed to get in high school. I continued to be the best player in a really good music program, just based on what I could do with very little work. But what that set up for me was that I didn't really know how to work hard until I got to college, and I was surrounded by people who were better than I was. And so I didn't really learn how to practice until I got to Michigan State. And frankly, I probably didn't even get good at it until my master's. And so I did not take lessons. I think I took, you know, maybe 6 months of lessons in ninth grade. And then I took maybe a couple more at the end of high school, but I didn't study at all, in a consistent way. I would practice when I needed to, and I did not practice when I didn't need to. I kind of ended up being the mallet person, as many women do in their studies at some point. So my timpani and snare chops were far behind what they should have been. So that was a big focus in my undergrad. But I was on drumline, so like my hands could move. And that was really only because somebody told me that I wouldn't be able to get a spot on the tenor line. So I did. And I was the drummer in the jazz band because somebody told me that, you know, in the history of my high school, no female had ever been the drummer in the jazz band. So, of course, I had to do that. So everything was like, I did a lot of things and I was involved in everything, but I only worked as hard as I needed to get approval, to get an A, to get a 1 at festival, whatever it was. Like, I wanted to do that, but I didn't really care about getting better than that until college.
Man, this, so much of what you said I dealt with a lot of that too. Particularly in the, I think it was like the masters when I was finally figured out how to actually really practice.
Yeah.
I was like, Oh, all right.
Yeah, it's hard. And when I was noticing other people, like, seemingly figuring it out when we were, you know, sophomores, it's like, are you getting different lessons than I am? Like, how do you know how to do this? And finally, somebody just said, like, yeah, I know you can already play this, but it takes me a while to learn how to play this. And, you know, you were like the golden child at your high school, but I had to work at it. And all of a sudden it hit me like, you've been working this whole time? Like, I am behind. I'm so behind. So
just following this through a little bit, did you figure out, was it conversations like that, or was it that maybe the extrinsic motivators weren't as available as they once were, and you had to turn internal to improve? What do you kind of see that at this point?
I think the extrinsic motivators were still there, but, you know, I had maybe very limited understanding of what success was to me in high school. You know, success was first chair, or getting a 1 at solo ensemble, or being my band director's favorite, or whatever it was. And beyond that, it didn't really make any sense. I wouldn't say that I was a lazy child, but sure, I certainly was efficient in my energy output. Like, just did not do more than I needed to do. My mom actually describes when she saw me walk for the first time, she could like see the wheels turning in my head. It's like I was standing up holding the couch, and I saw a toy that I wanted across the room. And she's like, you could almost see the stages of thought where it's like, okay, I could kneel down, crawl across the floor, and then stand up again, or I could just walk, and that would actually be less work. So I think I'm just going to do that. And then I walked across the room. So it's like that sort of, like, why spend more time and more energy on something than you need to was sort of how I lived as a kid. So it was kind of like, I didn't have a bigger idea of what success could be. The idea of I'm just going to practice to get better, there was no goal for me at that point. It didn't make any sense to do that because it wouldn't get me anything in the situation I was in. So I think when I got to college, I started understanding that there's more to life than, you know, the 15 people that are in my studio. Even if I am the best person in this studio at some point, there are still other people in the world, you know, that I'm going to be competing against. And so even if I'm continuing to do that extrinsic motivation, I just had to expand my worldview a little bit and think about long-term goals. And if I want to get into a good grad school, I'm going to be competing with more than the 15 people that are in my studio. So I think I developed some personal motivation, but I think I just, what helped was an expanded sort of worldview for my ultimate goals.
If you're familiar with the, this is not my term, but situational extrovert.
No.
I consider myself is like, I'm generally pretty introverted, but if like I have to be extroverted, I can like muster it up and be ready. And then like, I need to like be away from everyone to like take it down. Yes. I feel like there's sometimes a little bit of that in that kind of setting where you're like, all right, if for this spot, I can be like everything.
Yeah. Well, and I actually think that being like doing what we do and being educators, I mean, you kind of have to be an extrovert when you are in the front of a classroom.
Yeah.
But from understanding my own introversion, it's like, it's not that I don't like talking to people or I get nervous talking to people or I don't like big groups. It's that I don't like the mindless chatter sort of. So it's like when I'm in front of a classroom, I'm in charge. Like I have to make sure that something meaningful happens in the next hour because that's my job. And so I give a whole lot of energy to that. And sometimes it feels like I need to put on a Broadway show to get them to pay attention. Depending on what the topic is. And so giving all of that energy out is exhausting. And I need to recharge after that big time. I would say, I can definitely turn it on when I need to, but it does deplete my energy reserves big time.
Now, when you were in junior high school, were you involved in anything else outside of music, like sports, student government, church, anything else to fill out your time?
I tried to get into sports. I had very short stints in volleyball and track. It just was not my thing. I honestly think my biggest motivation was just getting a varsity letter. I wasn't really that into doing that kind of stuff. I would much rather just go home and read a book. So those things lasted 1, maybe 2 years tops each. And other than that, I think I was sort of at the tail end of the generations that were allowed to be bored. And I loved my alone time. And so my mom was a single parent and I was an only child. So that time from, 3 o'clock until 6 or 7 when she got home, I mean, that was my jam. Like, I loved that time. Just doing my homework, reading, maybe watching a little trashy TV, hanging out with my cats. I mean, loved it, you know? So I really didn't want to give that up for anything else. So I did, I tried a few things and, you know, it just didn't really work. I got into musical theater in high school. That took some extra time, but yeah, that's pretty much it.
What roles or what shows were you in?
So I did Anything Goes and Crazy for You. And I had a pretty healthy dance background. I danced for about 12 years before I had to give it up. In ninth grade, it was like, I was at the point where I was, I don't even know why this didn't occur to me, but I did do a lot of dance. I was right at the point where I was getting really serious about dance, and I was pretty much in line for the role of Clara in the Nutcracker for my freshman year of high school. But that was also the year that marching band started. So I kind of had to make a decision about which one I wanted to do, because I couldn't do them both. So I went the marching band route and I stopped doing dance. But because I had all that background, I could take on roles that required a lot of dancing. So I didn't have a great voice. I was in choir senior year, but, you know, nothing to write home about there. And so I could carry a tune and I could be an ensemble member, didn't really have the chops for a lead role, but the lead roles also didn't really have the dancing. It was sort of that second tier level that had the dancing parts. And so I pretty much got similar roles in both of those shows. And that was kind of fun to be on the other side of it. I actually do a lot of musical theater now, or I did in Florida and Georgia, but my first experience with it was actually being on stage, and it was a lot of fun.
Doing like community theater kind of stuff?
Yeah, because, I mean, you think about Florida, like, that is a great place to have a bunch of community theaters, you know, lots of old people to come and fill the seats. And so I would do 3 or 4 shows a year in Florida with, like, you know, 2, 3, 4 week runs of each one. And it was a lot of fun, and it got me to buy a lot of equipment, fill out my collection. But yeah, it was like the most consistent gig down there. It was great.
When you were studying dance, was it like jazz, tap, ballet or something like that? Or was it just ballet?
I did tap when I was a kid, and then that kind of went away. So it was mostly jazz and ballet after that. And then, of course, my first year in the Nutcracker was when I was 6, and then sort of moved up to different roles within that time period. But yeah, I definitely did a little bit of everything. I think the taps really annoyed my ears. As an introvert, I wasn't big on that, so I let that go pretty quick.
But that's the most percussive of all of them. So
it is, but I was not a percussionist yet, so I had tapped into that part of my psyche, I suppose.
Tapped into it. Nice. I like it. I did that. Awesome. I'm curious, how were your feet like after you stopped dancing? Because, I mean, don't they take a pretty, they take a lot of abuse if you do ballet, right?
They do. And I hadn't done a whole lot of point work. And okay, So my feet weren't a mess yet. And that was honestly one of the reasons. We had a close family friend who was a professional dancer. She had been in the same Nutcracker production that I had been in, and she was Clara, and she was the whole nine yards. And then by the time I got to be that age, she was like off doing the professional ballet dancer track. And she just, I mean, her feet were a disaster and she had all kinds of physical problems. And so I kind of looked at that and went like, do I really want to do, I mean, I definitely don't think I want to be a professional dancer. So why bother continuing doing this for a couple years when I could switch over and do this new thing that seems kind of cool. So yeah, I kind of sidestepped the worst of that.
I gotcha. Now, a side note, are you a fan of the movie Center Stage?
No, not really. You know, maybe if I'm sick and I'm just watching movie after movie on the couch, perhaps. But no, not really. It's like it's sort of like if we watch Drumline, it's like, well, that's just ridiculous. That's not what any of this is like. So it's sort of similar. Like it's not that dramatic.
Yeah. I mean, there's some in the Drumline, at least in the HBCU community, there are a fair amount of parallels, but it's not as sure.
The idea of like not reading music or, you know, watching the hands of the person playing. And it's like, that's not what you're playing right there. I mean, it's really easy to poke holes in.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I taught at an HBCU in Florida, and there was sort of an equal amount of love and disdain for that movie. So.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that is for sure true. Now, coming back up here, so when you first get to Michigan State, what's kind of the when you first realized that, like, this is a completely different place that I'm at now?
You know, when I was doing my auditions, I auditioned at Michigan, Michigan State, and Central Michigan. And I really observed, first of all, like how I felt there, because I had such a visceral connection to Kalamazoo that I wanted to find that same kind of connection, hopefully at a new place. And so when I was at Michigan State, it just, everything felt right. Everything felt, it's like, yes, this is where I'm supposed to be. You know, I'm hearing other people play and I'm seeing all of these rooms, and I'm seeing all these instruments, and it's like, this, yes, this is it, you know? And I felt similarly at Central. So they were kind of neck and neck. Michigan was a very strange time when I was looking to transfer. There was a lot of animosity within the studio. The professors were kind of fighting with each other, and it just seemed like kind of a toxic environment. So kind of crossed that off pretty soon after leaving. But when I got to Michigan State, it was like, you know, I felt great there. I got a full ride, like everything fell into place. And even though it was a little, it was a little intimidating, but it was a good kind of intimidating. It's like, I didn't realize that I was missing the competition, the healthy competition of seeing, you know, people in the top band, like the grad students and stuff, watching them play in studio class. I didn't realize that I was missing that kind of stuff at my last place and in high school too. And so it felt, it could have felt overwhelming easily, but I was just, I totally ate it up because it finally felt right, I think.
Now, who was the main professor there at the time?
So the professor was Allison Shaw. Okay. And that is one of the biggest reasons that I went there. We really hit it off and I thought we would work well together. And then after that first year of studying with her, she left unexpectedly for everybody. And so that was kind of a gut punch that I had transferred to study with her. And then she had to leave for, you know, a bunch of reasons beyond her control. And so then Dave Hall, who is, was and still is in the Grand Rapids Symphony, he filled in for her as interim. And we had a search that year, which was my junior year, and it ended up being a failed search. So he stayed on for another year, and we had another search my senior year. And that was the year that Gwen was hired. So I never actually studied with her, but that was, she came in right as I was leaving.
Wow. I mean, what is, okay, so looking back now, what does that seem like with having multiple, so many teachers having kind of a weird situation where it's like, this is not the full-time person, but it's, they're doing the job. I mean, what do you see as like, what happened, I guess?
Yeah, it was rough. And I think my undergrad experience, it's one of the reasons that I stayed at UMKC for my master's and doctorate, because I never had that long-term relationship with a studio professor who could create a vision for me and a plan of here's where we're starting and here's where we're going to get to. You know, it's like my first year was sort of haphazard because I was prepping for auditions, and then I got there and I started with Allison, and then that kind of stopped abruptly, and then Dave came and then he had a different idea. So I didn't get that basic fundamental experience that you usually get as an undergrad. So by the time I got to my master's, like, I still didn't have good snare chops. And I still, it's like, on the one hand, it was great because I got a lot of perspectives from a lot of different people, but I just didn't have a good foundation. So I, like, my first 2 weeks of my master's degree, I played quarter notes on a practice pad. Like, I mean, we just broke everything down and started from scratch, which was great. And so I got that consistency throughout grad school, but it was challenging, as an undergrad to go through three professors in 4 years. And, also I was the student representative on the search committee for that position. And I kind of saw, you know, how the sausage got made behind the scenes, and that was sort of disheartening as an idealistic undergrad as well. So I learned a lot during my undergrad time.
Yeah. Like, here's what I think, and then they'd be like, yeah, fine. And then
kind of. it was so being there was one representative, one grad student representative and one undergrad. So I was the undergrad for both years. And, you know, the director of the School of Music gave a big song and dance about how they really wanted feedback from the studio, and I was going to be the liaison between the search committee and the studio. And so I didn't have ideas of grandeur that, like, I was going to get an actual vote on, you know, whoever was offered a position, but I took it very seriously to get my fellow students excited. Especially the second year, it was harder to get them on board with coming to all the master classes and everything because they had already done it once before and nothing happened. So we had to work really hard to talk them into, like, this is important. Please come to this talk. Please come to this master class. Please fill out this questionnaire so that I know how you feel about it. You know, how do you feel about their education philosophy? And how do you feel about this? And what do you think about that? And I did this exhaustive work, and I put all the data together, you know, and I went in to present the data very professionally, you know, and to the director of the School of Music. And, you know, I did my 5-minute spiel or whatever, and he said, okay, cool. Well, here's what we're going to do. And, like, they had already decided what they were going to do. And it just felt like, why did I even do any of this? Like, why did you even pretend to care about what we thought? It's okay if you don't care. You know, we're just students. But right. Why bother going to all of this if you're not even going to listen to what we have to say? So it was a little disheartening, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But ended up being a great hire. And,
yeah,
you know, I think she was quite young, but she found her footing after a few years, and it has done only positive things for State. Oh, yeah.
No, she's tremendous. She's been, I had her on show a few years ago. So yeah, she's pretty great.
And you'll get to hear part two with Marya next week. So stay tuned. This week's rave is the classic 1992 film Wayne's World, starring Mike Myers as Wayne and Dana Carvey as Garth, and directed by Penelope Spheris. While over the years, I've seen clips of this film here and there, I had not had the opportunity to watch the film in its entirety since when I first watched the film when I was in high school. And here's the good news, it still mostly holds up. One of the fun activities for old people like myself is to have the discussion about what was the best cast of Saturday Night Live. I feel fortunate that when I was really starting to tune into the show regularly as a teenager, it was during its late 80s and early 90s heyday, when the cast had, among others, Kevin Nealon, Chris Farley, David Spade, Adam Sandler, Phil Hartman, Chris Rock, John Lovitz, Jan Hooks, who I've mentioned before, was probably the best actress ever on the cast, and of course, Mike Myers and Dana Carvey. So I was all ready for the movie when it came out, and I loved it then, and I definitely needed to see it all over. The plot barely matters in this case because this is all about the wonderful relationship between two best friends and the joy they have about everything and everyone they encounter. I still remember tons, whether it was Garth's I Like to Play or Alice Cooper's Milwaukee, and of course the Bohemian Rhapsody scene in the car, which pushed the song back onto the pop charts, and many, many other great moments. There's a lot of great stuff I completely forgot, like some of the practical jokes they pull, to Ed O'Neill as a nihilistic bartender, to essentially all of Rob Lowe's character, and particularly the scene where he speaks Cantonese. There's a lot. But really, it's one of those movies where you're just happy to be among friends again. You've missed hanging out with Wayne and Garth, and you wanted them back in your life, and here they are. So check out, again, Wayne's World. You'll be glad you did. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. All of the episodes and the show notes are always at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com. And I'll catch you next week for part two with Mario Carney. Until then.